Hello, everyone. This is Sam Berenbaum. Welcome to another episode of Fuel for Thought by AutoWorks. It's a beautiful Friday afternoon. It is winter in Arizona. It is clear skies, very low humidity, nothing new there. And I'm sitting upstairs in the Auto Clubhouse, lounge, movie theater. There's a bar. There's everything. Very, very busy, as always, here. And what do we have to report this week? Well, we had some very, very good sales. One owner from new V10 Audi R8 Spider manual, white over black leather. That car sold for $150,000 with 28,000 miles on it. Very nice car. Very happy for the seller and very happy for the buyer on their new acquisition. The car is actually going across the country to Maryland, so it will be put to good use in the Northeast winters, the Chesapeake winters. What else do we have going on here? The Agate Gray 2015 GT3, a two-owner car from new with 13,000 miles, bucket seats, sport chrono, some spare HRE wheels, AP racing brakes, half roll cage. That car sold for $147,500. So very, very good result on that car. That one was actually put on Bring a Trailer. Our friends over at Bring a Trailer are great. We really see fantastic numbers on their website, and I highly recommend it to everyone. When they say, oh, you know, I'd like you to sell a car for us, I say, well, let's put on Bring a Trailer, because the numbers I can get on there are just fantastic. You have thousands of people watching your auction from all over the world, and you have many people from all different walks of life. The comments are great. They actually, I think they more so help the sale of the car than hurt, just in my experience. I know there may be other stories to tell, but I've been very, very happy with Bring a Trailer's results. Part of the team right now is at the racetrack. The AutoWorks racing program is really in full force. We now have, let me count here, 1, 2, 3, 4. I think it's like 5 or 6 race cars that are privately owned by members of the club that we service, maintain, and then also bring to the track, and we coach members, and it's very extensive. It's very professional, and, people have been loving it. I mean, it's to get out on the track and have a full staff at your disposal to coach you, to prep your car, to kind of give you the skills and techniques you need in order to maybe not perfect your driving, but come close to it, is really, really a great service that we provide. And I think anyone who may be a little intimidated of track driving, because, you know, if you've never done it before, it can be something, oh, you know, driving on the track, there's a little bit of mystique. Is it dangerous? Is it, you know, too fast? This is a very good way to dip your toes into that world of track driving. So whether you're a professional, whether you are a seasoned, you know, track driver, or whether you are a novice, I'm for sure a novice. So anyone can participate. It's kind of open for any of our members of the club. So if you want to get into that, I highly recommend reaching out and inquiring, because there's a lot more details as far as that program goes. We are happy to announce our new colleague, Robert Borham, who has over 30 years of Porsche experience. He also is a very, very fine mechanic when it comes to a bunch of other marks. He works on Aston Martins, he works on Lancia, Alfa Romeo, the list goes on. His real pièce de résistance is his setups. So he does unbelievable setups on these cars, track setups. Also depends on what track you are tracking your car at or racing. However, his setups are so precise, and he does so much more than just toe in and camber. He, as I call him, I'm not sure if he likes that I call him this, but I say that he's the setup guru. And we're very, very lucky and very happy to have him at Auto as our AutoWorks tech and mechanic. He's quite, he's a maestro. He's up there with John Wilhoit and the best of the best. So he's really, he knows what he's doing. What else do we have? We have actually some new members of the club. So we have had some new vehicles join in the collection room, one of which is a beautiful all white 911 R, no stripes. Beautiful car. Another car, new member, actually another white Porsche, a 997.2 GT3. It's actually the only 997 in the building out of all 120 or so vehicles that are in the collection room and even in the garage bays too. It is the only 997. So I love that car. I love 997s. It's nice to see a 997 here and there. After you're inundated with 991 and 992, so 997s are a nice return to form. This particular car has the folding bucket seats and it has no sport chrono and has a non-leather dash, which you would have if you didn't have sport chrono. So it's very, it's a specification that I would highly recommend. I don't think the sport chrono is anything anyone needs. It's a wart on your dashboard, so you may as well just rid yourself of it and save yourself a little money when you order a car. Anyway, today, enough talking. I'm having verbal diarrhea right now. Today we have a very special guest who actually Eli and I met in person at the Monterey Car Week Cantina. If you have ever been to Monterey Car Week, there's a Mexican restaurant and drinks joint essentially that everyone who is anyone is at, and they're having drinks and tacos, and it's a good time. So we go there pretty much every day during car week. It's very low key, it's very casual, it's very fun, and you strike up conversations with people throughout the industry. So we saw Bassem Wassef there, who is also on another podcast. He's actually coming on in a few weeks for a return leg. And our friends Cam Ingram and our friend Peter Brotman and Steve Cirio, they were all there. So we'd have a really good time. Magnus Walker was there and his lovely girlfriend Hannah Elliott, and they're all just enjoying. And then we struck up a conversation with today's guest, Mr. Porter, Greg Porter. Now, Greg is as much of an encyclopedia on cars as anyone, because he's the lead specialist collector, excuse me, the lead specialist of collector motor cars and automobilia at the Simeon Foundation and at Bonhams. So he really, really knows his stuff, and I spoke with him for probably an hour just about minutiae, things that car people can talk about, like the clutch feel on this car versus on another. To be honest, it's I hear myself talking like that and I say, what the fuck? But then again, it's interesting. So if you like cars, this will be a good episode for you. I'm going to dial him in very shortly in the next few minutes. So we will catch back up with all of the listeners in the next few minutes. For now, go grab yourself a beer, or coffee, or what else? Maybe a tea. Tea is good, or some sort of cafe mocha. I don't know. Just settle down, take a break. Everyone works so hard. Put your feet up. Listen to a podcast. Listen to some people talk about cars and nerd out a bit. And hey. We're going to try to do more podcasts more frequently and regularly. So I appreciate the support. We all do. Here is Mr. Greg Porter. welcome to the podcast, and we're happy to have you.
Thank you very much. It's good to be speaking over the phone about cars.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much what we do on here. It's just me today, solo. Eli is at the track with the Auto Works team. So it's just going to be you and I. We'll start chatting. I think we should just get right into it. Tell us who you are, a little bit about yourself. I kind of did a brief intro, but I think the audience would like to hear from you.
Thank you. Well, my name is Greg Porter. I'm a consultant specialist for Bonhams Auctions. I've been in this, doing that job since 2015. When I joined Bonhams. Before that, I've always been kind of a car guy. My dad raised me in the hobby. He built a vintage Bentley in our basement when I was 2 years old. So I had the privilege of like rallying all over the world with him. And basically every weekend, you know, I'd be woken up early, like, you know, Greg, do you want to go to the, you know, he'd always have cars in, you know, one of his friend's shops. And it would always be like, well, do you want to go work on the cars? And so pretty much a lot of the weekends I'd be leave early with him and go to one of his friend's shops where the cars were and, you know, rebuild an engine or do a brake job or do all that stuff. So that kind of gradually turned into a living for me. So now I work for Bonhams and I also spin wrenches in my spare time for people who need help with their cars. So that's kind of what I do.
Cool. So what was your first foray in the world of cars as far as a work experience goes? Where was your first automotive related job?
So that's an interesting story because I graduated with a master's in experiential education at the exact wrong moment in 2009.
Yeah.
And so within like a year of working in that field, there pretty much were no jobs left in that field. It was just kind of a mess. And so I said, well, the one thing I can do is, you know, go to tech school and get a technical degree. So I went to the UTI NASCAR Tech in Mooresville. And then my first job after that is I moved out to Seattle and I worked for a classic car dealer out there. As kind of a mechanic and just all around guy in the shop. So that was my first foray into it and then kind of continued doing stuff and then moved back to the Southeast. And then one thing led to another and I just ended up working for Bonhams. But so it was kind of a bit of a whirlwind kind of deal, but, I've had a great time. And continue to have a good time and learn a new something new every day. So it's always that's one of the best parts about this job, working in the automotive field when you're a car guy, you never know everything. Like there's always another old book to read about automotive history or some design feature on some esoteric car that you never heard about or some designer. So it's always, it's an adventure every day, pretty much.
So how has, if at all, how did your concentration in school play into what you do now? And does it at all? Or is that just, you know, a completely separate field of study?
Well, actually it does because my undergraduate degree was in humanities and in art. So then, you know, my postgraduate degree in education, I still, you know, have time to do. There's aspects of that that kind of transfer over, but not in the way you would kind of think they do. But the undergraduate in humanities and in art is something I use quite a lot of because, you know, you learn how to research in school during that. You learn how to write. You learn how to really trace down source materials. So when it comes to doing, you know, research on automobiles, a lot of that, I learned in doing in college and looking at things from a very critical perspective, from a design and artistic point of view, I also learned during my undergraduate.
Very cool. So Let's talk about this Bentley. Let's talk about your father's Bentley, because we had spoken about it when we had met at the cantina in Monterey, briefly, but I think this is a good medium to sort of dive into a little more. So, what's the story with that? What year is it? What model is it? How did he get hold of that car? That sort of, that sounds to me like it is a very, much so a taproot car for you. It sort of started your obsession.
Yeah, it did. The Bentleys kind of started my obsession with everything. So to start off that story, I have to tell you that the root of my dad's obsession is
Yeah,
I'm a
please.
first generation American, American born. My dad was born in Oxford, England, and he kind of grew up on both sides of the pond, going back and forth with because his parents were his dad was an academic and traveled a lot.
Cool.
So when he was about 8 or 9 years old, his favorite aunt came over to their house with a boyfriend for the inspection of the older sister. And he was driving a 1928 4.5 liter Bentley. And this was in the 1950s. I mean, at that time, it was just a used car.
Right.
And he showed up in this, black Vanimplateau. When you say, a Bentley, that's an image a lot of people have in their head, or an old Bentley.
Right.
And he gave my dad a ride. And my dad was into cars, but then he was like hooked. And he was like, I am going to own one of those.
Wow.
So he spent kind of a long time looking for, had a family, da da da, and then. A friend of his in the Bentley Drivers Club called him one day, and he remembers like rushing in, hearing the phone ringing in the house and like opening the door and like rushing to pick up the phone. And it was one of his buddies from the Bentley Drivers Club who said, John, I found you a car. And it's in California. It's a 4.5 Bentley. It needs a lot of work, and it's from a divorce. So the price is good. So my dad was like, okay, put him in touch.
And where
And
was your dad living at the time?
Wisconsin,
Okay.
which was a interesting place to be a car collector in the 1980s, because there was a lot, and there still are some great cars in Wisconsin, but at that point in time, there were some really fantastic things that were hidden away in Wisconsin because of Elkhart Lake.
Cool.
And my dad went, basically sold a Mercedes 280 SL that he'd owned for a while to buy that car. And that was in 1983 when I was one. And then the car kind of came to, actually, that had to be 84, because I kind of vaguely remember that car like showing up, but not very well. And then basically, it went into he, within a month of getting it was in pieces in our basement. And over the next 3 years, he totally restored that car, to and got it. It got a new body. The body was very odd when we got it, and not the original. And so it got a new replica body that it was built by a guy named Simonson up in Ontario. And he did pretty much all of the mechanicals himself, and he did the final assembly of the car himself.
Wow.
And he actually won the Rolls-Royce National Meet with that car in 1980. I think that was 87 or 88
Wow.
when
So
it was
your dad's
kind
a
of
no
finished.
joke, serious mechanic.
Yeah, he still can run circles around me in the garage with certain problems. He hasn't slowed down much, but when it comes to those cars, he really understands them. And he basically taught himself. And the thing was, is you could buy, and you still can, you could buy the technical facts of the vintage Bentley, which had like how to do everything, and you would just read the book and figure it out.
Yeah.
And everything would kind of go from there. And you learn other tricks doing this stuff, but that was kind of the story of that car. And we had that car in rallies all over this country, up into Canada, Went to South Africa in 1994.
No way.
And at that time, he sold it after it, after he finished the rally in South Africa. He didn't want to sell it, but, you know, basically an offer he couldn't refuse came because the car went really well. And then he ended up with some other car, with some other six cylinder cars. And now we're back to having 2 4-cylinder cars again. So we've got a three, four and a half liter Bentley and a standard 3 liter.
Cool. Cool.
So that's what we're kind of back to. But that was kind of the genesis, is because I, you know, my dad was always working on the car. And so I'd always be working on the car with him.
So he now has two other Bentleys, and you obviously were definitely enthralled, you know, with that car and that world, and it led you to, you know, dive into it. What are some of the vehicles that you covet or love other than Bentleys? You know, where's your taste lie, and is that just personal, or is there a reason for that? Let's get into that a little bit.
Okay, well, there's a lot. I mean, if basically it has four wheels, I like it in some way, shape, or form.
Sure.
Like I will always, my first love is always going to be for the pre-war stuff.
Right.
Because just, you know, that's where, you know, it kind of started. I have a deep love for, you know, sports racing cars of the 1950s and 60s. Kind of during the golden age. I think we're never going to have a time again where people were driving out and out race cars to the track.
Yeah, no, that's
winning
over
their
now.
Races and driving home. Like that's never going to be, and there's something beautifully romantic about that. I would say the only decade that I'm like not, you know, that I find hard to find cars that I'm interested in is the 1970s after 1973.
So gas crisis, that era.
Yeah, that stuff, it's really hard to find something that was, you know, the early 930 turbo comes to mind, you know, in the late, you know, 1979.
Right.
But, you know, there's not as many great things, you know. 1976 wasn't a good automotive year for anybody.
That is true.
But, you know, then, you know, into the 80s, I, you know, especially when I see young timer cars that I used to see on the road, and a lot of them, you know, you don't see many because, you know, cars were just used and abused. You know, during that period, there's, you know, some of the Porsches, some of the early BMW M3 cars from, you know, the late 80s, right. Or M3 cars. Those are great.
Yeah, they're fun. They are
but
fun.
I kind of have, you know, going through everything, there's numerous cars that I really would love to own if I had all the money in the world.
Sure, sure.
I have a huge passion for GT40s.
Yeah, I mean, how could you not?
Oh yeah, the original and just that story of how Ford built that racing program is just, you know, it's there will never be a program like that again. But it was you know, an amazing story, and the characters who were involved in doing that, which is another, you know, big thing for me is not just the cars, it's some of the people that you read about that had an impact on this industry.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's so many good stories as far as the development goes of these cars. And I think the cars that I gravitate towards, obviously, it would be nice to own them, but I do not. But the cars that I'm around the most and the ones that I gravitate towards the most are the ones with really the best stories, because those stories then produce a vehicle that is something that's very interesting. And I even think about, you know, people ask me what's my favorite car, and I always, you know, discuss the Carrera GT. And, you know, I've been lucky enough to drive a handful of them, and the engineering is great, and they're beautiful, and the engine, but the story behind it is so fantastic, just like the GT40 development, or even the original 911R, or there's so many cars that have such good stories where there was a leader of a team that said, you know what, I don't care. We're making it this way. And to be honest, when it's kind of like one vision, one car, you end up getting a result that is very, very pure and very, very legendary.
And that there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, usually the more people you have involved in the design and everything else, it can work and it can also end absolutely horribly.
Right.
British Leyland is a classic example of things that have ended absolutely horribly when you look at some of the cars that they thought were going to be truly great machines, and they ended up building. Well, they're comical and they're interesting to look at, but there's just story after story of stuff that didn't work
Right.
because there were too many people involved.
What do you think is what's coming up, or I should say, what are some trends you've seen in the market recently as far as buying and selling, types of cars, makes and marks, popularity, etc.?
The trends have been interesting because it seems to be, the truly great examples of anything are selling incredibly well now.
Sure.
And, that I think has to do with a lot of collectors kind of having almost a fine art mindset when they do cure when they do go out looking for something. They tend to look for, the absolute very, very best. I think there's going to be a huge interest in, the young timer classics from the late 80s, 90s, early 2000s, and it's going to be a lot of the stuff that, quite hasn't popped yet. Audi A4 or S4s
Yeah.
from, those things I think are
That's a
going to
good point.
be are going to be are just going to take off. I think there's a lot of that stuff from that period, especially if it's a really good example that's been taken care of, that are going to be that some of the prices for that stuff are going to be really surprising. But I'm also very surprised at some of the interest that some of the, people have always said, well, the pre-war car market is going to disappear. It's going to just go away. And it has kind of surprised me
Yeah, what do you think
with
about that?
this. I think there's some truth into it where it will never be quite as strong as it used to be. But there is also the whole thing where, a car guy is a car guy. And so if you have someone who's into, let's say they're into, 60s, 50s and 60s Ferraris, and they're that's what the first thing they're into, or they're into Porsches, and then they get to reading, some esoteric book about, motor racing in the 1930s, which there's plenty of great books on that subject. And eventually they're going to be tickled, and they're going to be, their interest is going to get going, and they're going to go like, well, what about that, MG, what about a K3 MG or a, Invicta or
Right.
any of those other cars that people have been like, well, in 10, 15 years, no one's going to want that. Well, I think
I just
that
hope
kind
people
of,
are reading still.
yeah, well, or it wouldn't be just reading, it's just going on a rally.
Of
And
course, and
maybe
seeing it.
you're on the rally with somebody who's in something older,
Yeah, and you're,
and
I want to be that guy.
you see that that car is really good, and so suddenly you're like, well, instead of buying another Porsche, maybe I should buy this.
Right.
And so I do see a lot of that where there's been a lot of guys kind of who you wouldn't think would be getting into some of the older stuff. The bug bites them, and suddenly, they're into that. But
Yeah.
I mean, also there's a lot of people who, a lot of younger collectors, there's a fair amount of young collectors who are passionate about, brass cars. And when I say young collectors, those guys under 50. Because, those cars are a very unique experience, especially a big horsepower one. That you can't A 9.5 liter four cylinder kind of has to be felt to, be
To
appreciated.
even believe it.
Yeah. And some of those, I mean, you can't get that experience from anything else.
Yeah, I've never, I can't really comment on that. I've never had that experience in that era of car, but I'm sure, like you said, if you like gasoline and you like mechanical things, I mean, you're not going to enjoy that. It's a pretty visceral and fun experience.
The most terrified I have ever been has been in a 1908 Lozier,
So talk to us a
which
little bit
is
about that. I want to hear the whole, let's hear the whole
so
detail on that, all the
an 08
details.
Lozier is basically a Lozier was this fantastic early American make that sadly did not went out of business at the start of World War One, but they made truly fantastic cars.
Okay.
And they made very fast cars. They, you look up old racing, and there's even like a dispute where, Lozier claims they won the first Indy 500 because they said the laps weren't counted correctly. But these are, they were very, very expensive, but they are incredible machines. So a friend of mine has an 08 Lozier, and it's a four cylinder, over 9 liters. It's got a four speed transmission, and the fourth gear is overdrive.
Wow.
It was in the early part of its life, it was raced until like 1918. And he invited me to kind of ride along with him on a rally. And I've driven some brass stuff, and I've driven Rolls-Royce Silver Ghosts, which are very elegant and they're very refined. But he had me in this thing, and I went, holy God. I mean, we are going 70 miles an hour. You can't hold on to anything. You're basically sitting on, you're way up in the air, sitting in a seat. No seatbelt, no nothing, and this thing still has power. And it was one of the it was a, an incredible experience, but it was also like I've been much faster in I've been I've been in serious race cars, and that car scared me more because it was like I had no idea that this thing was going to be booking down this country road at 70 miles an hour in overdrive fourth, just screaming
Jeez.
along.
And what year was that car?
That's 08.
Oh, so they were making them, is that 1908?
1908.
Got it. Okay.
I mean, it was a that car, stuff like that is an experience, and it's kind of not something that you can, you
Wow,
can't quite unquote
1908.
replicate that
That's
experience.
pre-Model T. Like what? What cars were like, what were its contemporaries?
The contemporary for that car would have been a Silver Ghost. Hard for me, but a lot of people don't realize how many car manufacturers like were existed in like pre-1914 America. I mean, there was stuff everywhere. There was, Winton would have been a contemporary of that car. That was up in Cleveland, Ohio. Alexander Winton, that's another, fascinating story that a lot of people don't know. I mean, that guy's story. And it's, if you have a chance, read up on that gentleman because that's a true American story of, an immigrant from Scotland, being a mechanic on a steamship and then being like, oh, I'm going to build a car. So
Where
there's,
was Kate was Who's Kaiser or Kaiser? We have a Kaiser here. Were they American or were they English?
Kaiser Darren or just a Kaiser?
I think it's just a Kaiser.
I'm pretty
It
sure
has
that was.
sliding doors, six cylinder. I don't think it's it, this car, this particular car we have here, I believe is from the 40s, but when it was pulled in, I was like, "What is that?"
Kaiser was American.
Okay.
And they were up in Michigan. And they're one of those companies that they made some really cool things. Their styling was pretty radical, and I mean they did make some very interesting stuff up until the point that they went out of business.
Right.
But a lot of people just don't know that there were, you know, hundreds of automotive manufacturers in the United States before World War One. There were, you know, a lot of automotive manufacturers, you know, in the 1920s. But, you know, with the Great Depression, I mean, the Great Depression killed off a lot.
It wiped out a lot of these brands and these companies.
Yeah. There just wasn't the, you know, with that kind of economics, you know, you can only survive if you're really big. So the big three are kind of the remaining of the automobile industry. But, you know, America has a very rich automotive history that a lot of people don't know about.
That is very true. That is very true. And now we have some more up and coming smaller manufacturers that are kind of coming back into the mix, which is nice to see. And I hope that they can survive and eventually become, you know, somewhat players with the big three as well. Like, you know, you have Lucid and a bunch of these other Bollinger Motors and obviously Tesla. But I think it would be nice to see more manufacturers that are in America. I mean, you have, listen, I love European cars and Japanese cars, but we have the space. We have people who are pretty skilled artisans and can create these cars, and we have good engineers and good brains here. So get to it, people, you know?
Yeah, but it's also amazing to see what, I mean, the American manufacturers have been able to do on the performance end of things. You know, in the past, over the past, you know, 10 years,
right.
I mean, it's now to the point where, you know, a Ford GT, a new one is every bit the supercar Ferrari is.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And the same thing, you know, with the, you know, new Mustangs that are out, you know, you look at their Nürburgring times. I mean, they're right up there. They are seriously quick.
Oh yeah. They're great. The new GT500s drive phenomenally. I've driven a few of them, and the gearboxes, putting a dual clutch gearbox in a Mustang completely changes the whole feel of the car. I think your gearbox, as much as your engine, gives you a good feel of how, I think, refined, but also a gearbox can make a car feel more or less expensive in a way. I don't want to say luxurious. I want to say expensive, because I wouldn't call a Mustang luxurious. But when you have a nice, well-calibrated, fast-shifting, you know, dual-clutch transmission, but you get in, it's a Mustang, it's like, wow, it sort of brings it up a few notches.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, the hats, you know, kudos where kudos are due, because they have been able to, you know, In the 1990s, it was known that, you know, basically, if you wanted a car that handled, you didn't buy an American car.
Right.
And, you know, same for the early 2000s. And now, I mean, some of the stuff that is coming out of, you know, Detroit, whether it be from, you know, Chrysler or Ford or
Chevy's
Chevrolet,
making some great, like, these new Camaros are unbelievable to drive.
Yeah, they've really been able to step up their game, and I think it's great to see. You know, so I'm pretty excited about that in terms of looking at what they've been able to do in terms of making cars that are truly fantastic, and, you know, can compete on the world stage with stuff from Europe and stuff from Japan.
So Greg, tell us a little bit about your current job and what you do now, and give us a little insight into the world of auction houses.
So currently I'm you know, a consultant specialist for Bonhams. My kind of territory is the southeastern U.S. So I kind of my stomping grounds are pretty much from anything from Maryland on downward. And I'm one of the guys who goes out and you know, hunts cars, and, you know, gets the cars for the auctions.
Awesome.
So that's kind of my current job with them. And then also I run a little one-man show mechanicking shop for some of my clients out of my garage, because sadly there's not as there's not as many people who understand, you know, the pre-war stuff down here anymore.
Right.
So I do that for clients on request and help them out with, you know, rally preparation and getting their cars ready for driving season.
So what are there any kind of specific characteristics that lend themselves to the Southeast car culture in general? I can definitely tell you that, you know, I'm from the Northeast, born and raised. There's definitely a specific vibe and culture there. There's a whole different culture in LA. There's a whole different culture in Arizona, in the car world. What is that specific sort of je ne sais quoi, so to speak, about the Southeastern car culture?
The Southeastern car culture is changing fairly rapidly, and that's just simply because there's a lot of people moving to this part of the country. I mean, I live just outside Greenville, South Carolina. It's one of the fastest growing economic areas in the country. BMW is, you know, has a massive, I think it's the largest automotive plant in the country.
Right. That's where they build their SUVs, right?
In Greenville. So there's that. You know, we have Volvo is building a plant in North Charleston. There's the Porsche. You know, there's the Porsche has a big facility in Atlanta.
Yep.
It has just been, you know, it has kind of been a whirlwind of automotive down here. And because, you know, so many people are moving into the area, you know, we're getting it used to be, you know, the Southeast was kind of the place for serious muscle cars. Now there is. You know, incredibly active Porsche club, incredibly active BMW club. Mm. You know, it is changing very quickly, just because there's so many people coming into the area. You know, Atlanta is, you know, Caffeine and Octane, the largest automotive show in the country, and they hold it on a monthly basis.
Wow.
I think it is the they say it's the largest. I'm not sure if it is. But they say it's, you know, the largest show. So I'd have to check that. But I mean, you know, there, you know, you go to a Caffeine and Octane show and you will see everything. You'll see everything from, you know, a vintage Ferrari or a vintage Porsche to guys bringing out their, you know, Mitsubishi tuner cars and, you know, big off-road trucks that guys are really proud of. Like, you name it, you will see it. So the Southeast car culture is going to have a bit of a renaissance, I think, going forward, just because of so many people moving into the area. And, you know, we have so much automotive manufacturing now down in this neck of the woods. I mean, it just lends itself to that.
Very cool. Very cool. Do you do any track driving? Are you ever out on track, or is that not something you partake in? What do you think about that?
I've done, you know, the Skip Barber Racing Schools. I would like to drive on track, but it's just one of those things. Right now, I do not have the time for it.
Right, and I don't mean to sound like an asshole when I ask that. It's like, oh, do you drive on track?
I'm a quick driver. I would love to, you know, practice on track more. It's just one of those things that there's so much going on.
Sure, in terms
of doing everything. I can't do everything because I live right down the. I mean, Road Atlanta for me is about an hour and a half away.
Oh wow, that's great.
And that's an incredible race course.
Yeah.
But sadly for me, like, you know, you go over to the UK, the Bentley Drivers Club is incredibly active, with track days. And getting those cars on track. And, you know, it's incredible how some of those guys drive.
Sure.
I could say that, you know, even if I was driving on track, I wouldn't quite be that aggressive. you know, they're more active in the UK. And I would love to do more track driving. It's just one of the things I haven't had the time to really pursue.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it does tick up. You have to slot out pretty much full days to do it.
Yeah, and then plus there's, you know, getting the car ready and everything else. And I mean, right now I've got, you know, the two family cars that I've got to get ready for. I'm planning the Bentley Rally this next year
Cool.
in Charleston, South Carolina. So I've got a lot of irons in the fire, and it would be kind of, I wish I could, but it's just something I can't do right now.
Yeah. Bentley actually, Bentley North America may be holding an event with us at Auto, kind of an arrive and drive event for some of their new models. And then they have a partnership with Macallan. So well, I've been having a few calls with them about that, but nothing has come to fruition as of yet. So Bentley, let us know. We're happy to have you, and we'd love to do an event with you. But they're a
Bentley
very
and
cool brand.
Scotch, that's kind of going to be, that's a good match right there.
Oh yeah, it goes hand in hand. I mean, obviously, you know, the guests will drive first, and then the Scotch will come second. But I think because now it used to be Breitling, but now it's Macallan. So Breitling kind of took a back seat, and Macallan slotted in as their partner brand, which I actually think is a very good brand for them to partner with.
Well, I mean, I'm reading a book that was written by a woman named Elizabeth Nagel called The Other Bentley
Okay.
Boys. It's an old book. But I mean, those guys were wild.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
It's really hard to, you know, tell people exactly how wild they are. Like, people say we party now, but some of the stuff those guys did in, you know, the 1920s is like,
Yeah, it's not. Do you think that they were
whoa.
actually going that crazy, or do you think just like anything, it's like FOMO. Like you look on your phone and you see your friends are out and it looks like they're having the time of their lives, but you know, that's just one night and they're drinking. Or do you think that people back in that era were really going for it and just getting sloshed all the time?
I would say you have to look at it in terms of this, and it is in terms of, like, we are not the people that they were.
Right.
Like, you look at the main group of Bentley boys, you look at, you know, Wolf Barnato, Tim Birkin, Dudley Benjerfield, Glenn Kidston, all of those guys, and most of those guys who, you know, they. I think all of them served in World War
Sure, so you
I.
get that
So
as an
you have to
experience.
look at, like, these guys came back from literal hell
That's right.
on Earth for 4 years, and or 4 or 5 years, and they had absorbent, you know, these people were very well off. They had absorbent amounts of money. They then survived the Spanish flu epidemic
Sure.
that, you know, went through Europe. So I think they were pretty darn crazy.
Yeah, they at that
Just from
point
a
they were
psych,
saying, fuck it, let's celebrate.
yeah, just from a psychological point of view, these were guys who, you know, lived through, you know, and saw horrors that we really can't imagine. And so I think, you know, when it came down to it, they were as crazy as we read about.
Sure, and I think sometimes, you know, in their case, you better have a drink in your hand so you can deal with the next challenge.
Yeah.
When there's a
And
war and a pandemic and who knows what else.
it's kind of interesting because you really dig into the history, and, like, you look at Wolf Barnato, who was Wolf was chair of Bentley Motors, bought Bentley Motors pretty much in 1926, just so he could go racing. This was a man who was, you know, South African diamond tycoon, inherited his father died when he was 3 years old. He fell off the ship coming back from South Africa, and
Oh,
there's
God.
some people that say it wasn't an
Oh,
accident,
it was not an accident. That guy was pushed.
but there's other people that were like, no, it might have been an accident. He might have, you know, he whatever. But that's a different conversation. But, like, you look at that guy in terms of, you know, his entertainment budget was £2,000 a week, which was US$10,000 a week
Wow.
just for entertainment. He, you know, wins Le Mans. He hat tricks the 24-hour Le Mans,
Wow.
28, 29, and 30.
Wow.
And you look at him kind of later, there's a lot of pictures of him in the 1930s, and he was, you know, he was a retired professional athlete, because, you know, basically his job was basically to spend money and play. And, you know, he was a cricket player. He was a polo player. I've read somewhere that he was a boxer, but then read other places that, you know, I can't confirm or deny that. But then in World War II, he became a, you know, he mustered back in. And at that point in time, he was General Barnato. Hmm. And you look at him in 1938, before the war, and, you know, he's a retired professional athlete. And he looks like he was a retired professional athlete, where you could still see this was a guy you wouldn't want to throw down within a bar.
Right.
You look at him in 1947, and it is like, oh my God, he's aged, you know, 15, 20 years in the span of, you know, in that, you know, 6 year World War II span. I mean, you know, it basically took the life out of him.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting picture to see as you go, you know, well, there he was in 1938, you know, looking still pretty good. And there you see him in 1947, and he looks at like he's pretty much on death's door.
Jesus.
But I think, you know, reading these stories, I think those guys in that period of time, I think they had a very different assessment of risk and a very different attitude toward life.
Yeah, for better and for worse.
Yeah, like there are stories of Barnato had a country house called Arden Run out in the countryside,
okay,
in England. And the Bentley boys would go there on the weekend to party. It had a 1 mile driveway and
a hill climb.
There are numerous reports that those guys, when they were, you know, pretty well wasted at, you know, 12 o'clock at night,
sure,
would race their cars down and back on the driveway while intoxicated.
Oh yeah.
It was kind of like, well, you know, here we go.
Cars were also fairly new at that point, so people weren't really considering how dangerous they were, and drinking was such a part of life back then. I mean, people were having drinks at 11 a.m. You were drinking all day. You were drinking at work. You were drinking at every meeting you had. You were always drinking. It's just like smoking too. You were drinking and smoking. It was part of the culture.
But I think also there was, when you look at how fast those guys drove cars with the safety equipment, there was, that was a whole different level of courage. You know, you look at, you know, the first, the Mercedes-Benz Grand Prix team in, you know, 1936.
Yeah, I've actually read about that recently. There's that book about, crap, what was it called, about Dreyfus driving and how he competed against the Mercedes GP car in that era, in that race. And they were talking about just there was no safety. There were literally none. But
and
yeah,
there's I remember a number of years ago, they published a interview with Von Brosich, who was, you know, one of the guys who drove a W125.
Yes, yes.
And I remember it was like they waited to publish that interview till after he had passed, because he was very critical of modern racing and modern Formula One, which those guys are incredible athletes. But like his point was like, oh, well, you know, they think they know fear. Well, they don't know what I know.
Sure, sure.
Because, you know, he was telling these stories of, you know, driving a 125 at the Nürburgring, which was a 625 horsepower
supercharged
Grand Prix car,
yeah,
which in 1937, you know,
when cars were making 50 horsepower.
And, you know, he talks about like some of the experiences of driving that car. And I think David Coulthard drove one for Mercedes at a later, mm-hmm, point. And I remember him saying that someone asked him what it was like to drive, and I think he said it was like driving a modern Formula One car in glare ice.
Yeah, and also it's like an airplane engine. Literally an airplane engine. I remember reading the book, and crap, I wish I remember the title of it. I read it last year. But they were talking about how they were doing a high speed test in one of those cars on the Autobahn, and the Autobahn had just they had just started paving the Autobahn because Hitler had that whole project, public works project initiative, and he wanted all these Autobahns built, so they did it. And they closed one down and they tested one of those formula cars on the Autobahn, and I think something happened, a wheel fell off something, but pretty much the car just completely flew off the road. The driver was killed, atrociously. Is this a different, what do you?
I think you're talking about Bernard Rosemeyer.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And yeah, that was an Auto Union.
Okay, so that was an Auto Union car, not a Mercedes. Okay.
And I think it had something to do where it was a streamlined version of the car,
Yes.
and
Yes.
I think it was a little too streamlined, and it actually took flight.
I think that's exactly what happened, and he was killed. Like, because there was no threshold back then. Like, if you got into an accident, you were dying. There was no, oh, I'll get a little hurt, I'll be fine. It was you crash, you die. And back then, I always like thinking about it in this context. Like, did you, or I should say, because you had no relative knowledge of what something that was quote unquote safer would be, did you think that was as safe as you could have gotten? So you didn't have anything to base it off of, so you got it and you drove the crap out of it. Versus now, we look back, we know what something, because of development, because of evolution of cars, we can look back and say, okay, that wasn't safe in 1935. But now we know, even though Formula One cars aren't safe now, the chances of you dying are much, much lower. So I don't know. I think it all goes back to, like, did anyone know any better? And that's all they knew, so that's what they went with.
Well, I think, you can make that argument, but I think also that a lot of those guys, I think they're, if you look at, what they were doing, in World War One, or at least the ones that served in World War One, well, their idea of risk was,
Skewed.
running across no man's land with someone shooting at you.
Right, with a little whatever type of gun they
So,
were holding. I don't even know what they had,
yeah,
rifle and
I.
yeah, no
So
defenses.
when you come from that experience, or getting in a plane, or I think Birkin was in the air. I've got to look back and see if Birkin was in the Air Force or not. But or getting in a plane and having someone else shoot at you in the air with no parachute, I think then your whole perception of exactly how dangerous, getting in a race car in 1930 and driving at 110 miles an hour on Brooklands is.
Yeah, it was a piece of cake.
Yeah, I think at that point they kind of look at it as, yeah, this is dangerous, but it's not what we were doing 15 years ago. So we're just going to go with that.
Yeah, that's very true.
I think there was a lot of that kind of, well, we're not being shot at, so it must not be that dangerous.
That's right. That's right. That's a very good point. I agree with that.
Which when you think about it, it's like, you gotta kind of have a little bit of mental illness to think that way.
That, yeah. Yeah.
Because, you can guarantee that they knew people, there were people who were getting in wrecks in these race cars and they were dying.
Right, and they were still going out and doing it. Do you think that maybe it was because of the war that they had that mindset? Not because, okay, yeah, they weren't getting shot at, but the war may have fucked them up so much that then they're afterwards, they have no ability to measure risk.
I think, there might have been a little bit of that, but since, we can't go back and,
Right.
perform detailed psychological evaluations, we can't really know that for sure. But I think it was just, it was what it was. But it also, when you look at how many of these guys, how many people died in early motorsport or in motorsport in the 1920s compared to what exactly they were doing, it actually is a pretty, it's not that big a number.
Right. It's not that surprising.
No, it's not like, it's not like, you know, Formula One driving in the 1950s and 60s where basically you'd start a season and, you know, well, 30% of the guys might be dead by the end of it. You know, it wasn't that, but there was kind of a, I think there were a lot of different aspects to it. But I think there was also a thrill of being the first to do something.
That pioneer attitude.
You know, now we don't really have that, but I think, you know, there was the thrill to, you know, be the first person to lap Brooklyn's at, you know, an average of 110 miles an hour. There was the, you know, first person to drive, you know, to break numerous speed records at Indianapolis, because I think there was kind of that thrill of doing that. Because it was, and also the technology was moving so fast.
Do you think the technology has, the rate of development has slowed? And if, what do you think the next step is for racing? Because right now we're really limited by the tire, right?
Yeah, you're pretty much limited by the tire. But I think in terms of mechanical, you know, things when you're looking at just the base engine, there's a lot of people who think, you know, there's not many new ideas left. I think there's going to be always some engineer who's going to come up with something brilliant that people have not thought about. But I mean, there's certain things that you can do with in terms of combustion chamber shape and everything else that, you know, there's no new ideas there. Just because, you know, things have been thought of, and because you have to, you know, today you have to get more and more power out of smaller and smaller engines, and the engines have to be more and more efficient. So there is a little bit of a limit there, but I think, you know, the rate at which things developed with internal combustion engines in the early part of the last century mm-hmm. were, you know, you look at how fast people moved forward. It's really amazing. Like, you know, I remember we had at Bonhams a couple of years ago with the Bothwell collection, we had a 1914 Peugeot Grand Prix car.
Wow.
And I remember looking at this thing, and this was 1914. This has a dual overhead, you know, cam engine. It has, you know, pretty much a hemispherical combustion chamber. You know, stuff that was like, okay, you look at a Model T Ford, and then you looked at that thing and you went, oh my God. Mm. You know, these guys move forward with mechanical innovation incredibly quickly. And, you know, things got so much more powerful, you know, year in, year out. Which I don't think we see as much of that innovation today. I think you see a lot of things with, you know, trick computer programming, which, you know, you can tune engines today in a way that those guys couldn't even imagine doing.
Right.
Now, I mean, you can adjust timing within a fraction of a degree, which is pretty crazy when you think about, you know, how we used to do that.
That is very true.
So I think, you know, that's going to be the main thing is, I think, going to be in terms of, you know, airflow technology, probably, of how well you can make an engine breathe. I think there's probably stuff that people are still going to figure out. I think there's going to be solenoid controlled valves. Well, there already is that. But I think, you know, it's only a matter of time before you know, regular everyday production car has that technology. So I think there's all of that that's going forward. I think racing, it's hard to think, because racing now is very, very regimented. There's only certain things you can do. Versus, you know, when you look at,
right,
like,
there's a lot of rules and restrictions now.
Yeah, you know, the golden age of racing, well, what rules were they? Not much.
Power output and leaders, pretty much it.
Pretty much, you know, size.
Right, displacement and not much else.
But I mean, sometimes, you know, some of those displacements, you look at what those some of those displacement restrictions did in terms of the development of the engine. It's amazing to look at. Like I've got a book on my desk right now, The Golden Age of the American Racing Car, which talks about, you know, early American oval track racing in the 19, you know, basically around, you know, Indianapolis to the, you know, 1930s. But there's a Harry Miller is someone that's really covered very much in this book. And so it talks about Indianapolis limiting the size of the engines in 1926 to 1.5 liters. And so what does Harry Miller do? Comes up with a 1.5 liter engine that produces 250 horsepower
Right, innovative.
in 1926.
Pretty gnarly.
So there's all that stuff like that where I think, you know, rules do, when they're good rules, they do open the door for innovation in a way that, you know, a lot of other things don't, because inherently, if you can make, you know, 250 horsepower without having 1.5 liters and with doing less work and less cost, you're probably going to do it. But if you're forced to find, you know, that kind of power output, whether it be fuel economy or other things, that, you know, you will create something, you know, it will put pressure on great minds to create something that works.
Yeah, that's very true.
So I think that's a big part of it.
All
But
right, well, I think we're
it's hard
going.
for me to
Sorry.
think of where racing's going.
Yeah, I agree. Well, it's been a fantastic podcast. I think we're going to cut it here. Thank you so much for your time. And my intro was very accurate. You are a definite encyclopedia of knowledge. And we really appreciate you coming on the podcast, and I think we should do it again.
Sure, just let me know.
All right, no problem. Well, have a good night, and we will let you know when it all goes live.
You too, and enjoy your weekends and happy holidays.
All right, thank you so much. That was Greg Porter from Bonhams, a definite encyclopedia of knowledge. I am going to make sure the line is off. Okay, we're good. We hope that you enjoyed this podcast episode. We always are trying to do more. However, we're busy, so bear with us, and we will always let you know when there are more coming. Earlier, we had posted on the Auto Instagram a story with excuse me, a questionnaire option. So if anyone wanted to ask some questions for us to answer during this podcast, we could do so. So we're going to go through a few of those questions. We're just going to do three of them that are just the top questions here. Peter asks, where do you see the value of the C8 RS6 going in the next 5 years? C8, so that would be the most current one. I don't foresee those cars actually going down in value that much, just because high performance station wagons in general are rare, and high performance station wagons in America are extremely rare. I don't foresee them skyrocketing in value. I mean, they're not that limited. If you can get one, you could get one. I don't find that car to be an investment proposition for anyone. Just buy it and enjoy it, and you'll probably make money on it because someone's gonna like it. But I don't see the values tanking. Let's just say that. Guyan USA asks, what detailing products do you use? That's a better question for our detailer, Eric. However, I like Griot's. I don't really detail that much anymore. I used to wash cars a lot, but Griots is great. GRIOTT'S. And we have a great relationship with Adams. Adams makes some great stuff. Ammo makes great stuff. Fellow New York guy. And I like Griots. I think Griots is good. And I like their little traveling kit. Put everything in the bindi and you're good to go. Okay, last question. JWK Exotics, design inspiration for the club. That's definitely a good question for Eli, but I think I can pitch in there a little bit. I think the design inspiration and the architect who built this place, his name is Jack DiBartolo. The inspiration was, how can you create a space that is as timeless as the cars that are kept here? So there is a definite influence of the mid-century modern architecture that the Scottsdale and Phoenix region are known for. But then also, I think a main goal with the design of the, especially upstairs lounge and even the downstairs office space and library was, let's try to make this look as far from the standard I'm in a garage, man club, man cave as we can. So a lack of vintage neon lights and old gas pumps and stuff like that. How can we make this a timeless, very elegant space? And how can the space therefore incorporate the vehicles that are kept within it? How can the space be a good medium for the message that we are trying to put out? So I think that is a good answer for that question. If you have more design and architecture questions, please feel free to DM us through our Otto Instagram. That's definitely a big part about Otto that we love, and it's design and architecture. So have a good night, everyone. This is being recorded on a Friday, but it may not release until next week. So whatever day of the week it is, have a good night. And we hope that you join us for another episode of Fuel for Thought very soon. Bye-bye.